A few days ago, Hillary Clinton said this.
Well-educated young people, where were they getting their information? From social media, particularly TikTok. And what they were being told on social media was not just one-sided, it was pure propaganda.
And before that, former Obama speechwriter Sarah Herswitz said this.
Social media is now our source of media. The media you got in America was American media, and it was pretty mainstream. It's also this increasingly post-literate media. Less and less text, more and more videos. TikTok just smashing our young people's brains. Video of carnage in Gaza.
Those interventions have been criticized on many levels, and today I want to focus on this notion here.
It's also this increasingly post-literate media.
The post-literate society. If you follow the news, if you're on social media, you know that there is real concern around the decline of readership, the decline of literacy skills. Governments and institutions are investing a lot of money to make sure kids can read, and the results are mid. On the other hand, there is a lot of discourse around young people's use of social media and the impact it has on their mental health, but also on their ability to focus, to learn, and read. Once again, an increasing number of governments are reacting to this by implementing measures, programs, or laws meant to prevent kids and teenagers from using their phones at school or at specific time during the day. Now, this is coherent with what psychologist Jonathan Haidt has been pushing for decades now. He has written The Anxious Generation and is a big proponent of reducing phone use among younger people. I made a video about him about a year ago, I think, maybe. I'm quite critical of his work, and it's not just me, there's a group of academics and researchers who are very critical of the validity of his research. I dived into that academic debate in the video I just mentioned. You can watch that later, but for now, let's stick to our topic of the day, the post-literate society. The post-literate society, as Sarah Herswitz implies in her speech, and as we've just explained, mobilizes two types of discourse, the discourse on the decline of literacy and the discourse on social media use. Post-literate means after-lettered, so basically it signals a transition from a society where text is the dominant way people create, share, or understand information to a society where it has been replaced by other modes of communication. And we can't help but notice that there is a negative connotation attached to it, which translates into a desire to resist it, to fight it. When you think about it, most mainstream depictions of post-literate societies are pretty scary too. Fahrenheit 451, Idiocracy, or Wall-E. That universally negative bias towards post-literacy means that anyone who mobilizes that concept knows what reaction it will trigger among their audience. You just have to say post-literate society and people will nod concerningly. It has become common sense that it's a bad thing. You know me though, I'm always very skeptical when things become common sense, because when something is common sense, people don't bother questioning it anymore. You know, it's that thing of the contrarian 4-year-old constantly asking why. Well, personally, I haven't grown up. I'm still at that annoying contrarian stage of brain development, and I know many of my cool viewers are too, so yeah. My name's Alice. Welcome back to my channel. Today we're talking about the post-literate society. Oh, and by the way, don't forget to support the channel on Patreon if you like the content. We release exclusive stuff on there, monthly faves, etc. I put a link in the description down below. Do you spend way too much time stuck in your head, questioning everything over and over? Could that bump on my arm be a tumor? Do my friends really like me? Or are they just faking it? Did I accidentally say something offensive on my Instagram story? Am I a bad person because of the thoughts I have? For many people, that isn't just overthinking. If the doubts and fears are sticky and persistent, it can be a sign of OCD. And if that's surprising to you, it might be because OCD is one of the most misunderstood conditions out there. It's actually nothing like the quirky, I like things organized stereotype we often see on TV. Real OCD involves unwanted, intrusive thoughts that create intense distress, followed by behaviors you do to try to get rid of that distress, like replaying conversations over and over again in your mind, or constantly asking people in your life for reassurance. The problem is, those behaviors never help in the long run, because the thoughts always come back stronger. That's why OCD can be so debilitating. But it doesn't have to be that way, because OCD is also highly treatable with the right therapy. OCD needs a type of specialized therapy called ERP, or exposure and response prevention, not regular talk therapy, which can often make it worse. And that's where NoCD comes in. NoCD is the world's leading provider of OCD treatment, and every single one of their licensed therapists specializes in OCD and ERP therapy. They understand all the different ways OCD can show up, and they know how to help you get life back. Therapy with No CD is 100% virtual and covered by insurance for more than 138 million Americans. It also includes support between sessions, so you never have to face OCD alone. You can direct message your therapist, join dozens of live support groups, and use expert-developed therapy tools anytime. So if any of this sounds familiar for you or someone you love, go to nocd.com and book a free 15-minute call today to learn more. That's nocd.com to learn more and talk to someone who can help. Okay, let's go back to the video now. The demise of the Gutenberg galaxy. Okay, maybe we should start by acknowledging that there was something before the literate society, right? The pre-literate society, which preceded the literate society, or what Canadian cultural theorist Marshall McLuhan called the Gutenberg galaxy. McLuhan's idea of the Gutenberg galaxy refers to the cultural world shaped by the invention of the printing press and the rise of mass literacy. In his 1962 book, The Gutenberg Galaxy, McLuhan argues that once print became widespread, it reorganized the way people think, communicate, and understand the world. So this is the core idea. The Gutenberg galaxy is the era in which printed text, especially books, became the main way humans processed information. According to McLuhan, print culture encouraged first linear thinking, so that means processing ideas in sequence, individualism, reading is a solitary activity, visual-focused perception, text privileges the eye over other senses, then rational analytical thought, and finally standardization. It's the idea that mass-produced identical copies shape a shared worldview. McLuhan believed that the invention of printing didn't just make books easier to produce, it transformed consciousness. It pushed societies toward more structured and logical ways of understanding reality, in contrast to earlier oral cultures which were more communal and auditory. He used the Gutenberg galaxy as a metaphor, a whole constellation of cultural habits, cognitive patterns, and social structures orbiting around print technology. McLuhan also predicted that electronic media, so radio, TV, later digital culture, would pull us out of the Gutenberg galaxy and into a new environment, more like a return to oral interconnected communication, which he basically called the global village. You know, it's the idea that modern media connect everyone so instantly and intensely that the whole world starts to feel like a one big, tightly knit neighborhood. This shift is exactly what people now call a post-literate society. In a post-literate world, the written word is no longer the primary medium. Images, video, sound, and interactive media become central. Thinking becomes less sequential and more simultaneous or mosaic-like. Then communication is faster and more emotionally driven. And finally, people rely on multimedia interfaces instead of long-form text. So that's what we mean by post-literate society. McLuhan saw this coming very early on, when most people had only radio and early television. He suggested that electronic media would rewire our habits of perception, pulling us out of the quiet, solitary act of reading and back into a more collective, sensory-rich environment. You can think of it this way. The Gutenberg galaxy, the world is shaped by books, and in the post-literate era, the world is shaped by screens. So the post-literate society represents the cultural afterlife of the Gutenberg galaxy, the point where print is still around but no longer central. As we mentioned earlier, you can see versions of this idea all over science fiction, like WALL-E, in which humans mostly interact through screens and automated voices rather than text. We also talked about Fahrenheit 451, where society has shifted away from reading entirely, replacing books with fast immersive media. But you also have Star Trek. Characters often use voice-controlled computers, visual displays, and smart interfaces that make text almost unnecessary. You see, in these worlds, technology becomes so intuitive that reading feels optional. Culturally, though, the idea of a post-literate society raises important questions about, you know, how we think and learn. When communication becomes quick and visual, text-based forms of communication can be harder to apprehend. When you think about it, text is still part of the videos we watch. Creators often include captions, maybe you turn them on for this video, but this doesn't compare to the act of, you know, sitting down for an hour and just read a text with no other stimulation. So it's fair to ask, if culture keeps moving towards short videos and visual feeds, How will that change our ability to preserve complex ideas and teach critical thinking?
Skeptics like Clinton or Hurwitz romanticize the time when media was more centralized, a way to better control the narratives that are shared and passed on. Hurwitz explains that in the past, you'd need to go to a pretty fringe bookstore to learn about the sort of things you might get easy access to on the internet. And I understand her concerns. There is a lot of disinformation online, and tech platforms are reluctant to change that. But I want to make sure we agree on what we mean by misinformation, disinformation, or even fringe. See, a few months ago, I came across this post. It says, quote, "When someone disagrees with me, it's like, whoa, anti-intellectualism really is on the rise." Now, all those terms, anti-intellectualism, slop, disinformation, or misinformation, are increasingly used to refer to things we simply don't agree with. It's a way for us to intellectualize our disagreements, claiming we're the smart one in the conversation, we know better. And again, I'm not saying those things don't exist, but it's important to question their use. The choice of words matters. It really does. Words don't carry meaning by themselves. They are more like recipients into which people pour their understanding of the word. If you ask a Trump voter what freedom means, they'll probably answer something very different from, let's say, a Harris voter would. If you ask me what feminism means, I'll probably say something quite different from someone like Hillary Clinton. Similarly, when Clinton calls out propaganda, or when Hurwitz talks about disinformation, I'm curious to know what they mean by it. To me, they seem to mean all things that are not produced or endorsed by American legacy media. In fact, I find it interesting that Sarah implies that post-literate is bad, and that it is harming the Jewish community's ability to preserve Holocaust education. I find it interesting because Holocaust education is mostly communicated outside of text. I remember learning about the Holocaust at school through documentaries with images, videos, films, and oral histories. This makes sense because European Jewish communities were deprived of most of their textual means of communication, of their press. They carried knowledge of the genocide in the form of images, stories, and memories. Of course, we have Anne Frank's diary, but this diary was like most diaries, not necessarily structured or analytical. It was a collection of events and thoughts written in a conversational tone. Similarly, the carnage from Palestine that we see on our phones is one of the few ways Palestinians can communicate what is going on in their country to the rest of the world. At least 206 journalists have been killed since October 7th. Buildings and communities are destroyed. I was helping someone submit an application for a scholarship in Europe a couple of months ago and ended up on a Zoom meeting with a bunch of Gazans explaining they couldn't even get a signature, even less an academic reference. But contrary to European Jewish communities during the Holocaust, Palestinians have some access to the internet, and this has been crucial over the last decades. Not just to communicate with us in the West, but also to keep the Palestinian identity and culture alive. There's a wonderful book which I've meant to talk about for so long, I just couldn't find a way to do it, and I'm happy I finally get to share it with you in this video. It's called Palestine Online. It's written by Miriam Arurag, and it starts with this quote: "They can stop us at checkpoints and borders, but not on the internet." It's quote by Sharif Kanana. I thought I would organize those passages that I found interesting into a nice little paragraph highlighted and everything, but Miriam is such a good writer, so I thought I was just gonna read them to you, if that's okay, and you tell me what you think about them. The first passage is on page 25, and it says, "The internet comprises different forms of engagement. One can read, write, look at pictures, watch films, listen to music and live radio programs, talk with strangers, use a webcam to see each other while talking, download archive material, and so on. The internet can undermine the state's monopoly of the media, and the combination of new ways of acquiring and disseminating information have made it possible to form counter-imaginations." Still on that page a little bit later, "The main argument here is that mass media and communication strengthen national awareness among those in distant places, fuel a sense of community, and make it possible to experience the national's territorial contours." Then page 44, "Far from disembedding national identities, the technologies comprising the internet revive national sentiments and past or present dreams of becoming united again and incite the struggles related to such dreams." So basically, Palestine is divided in many territories. Some people live in Gaza, others in the West Bank, others in refugee camps outside of Palestine. And we know by now that opposition uses that to claim that there is no such thing as a Palestinian identity. But Miriam explains that social media actually help recreate that territory, that Palestinian identity, a form of transnational unity. Page 44, she uses the term slash board, the term long distance nationalism to explain what's going on in Palestine. And the last quote, it's actually from Žižek. Page 45, he says, "Perhaps cyberspace, with its capacity to externalize our innermost fantasies in all their inconsistency, opens up to the artistic practice a unique possibility to stage, to act out the phantasmatic support of our existence that cannot ever be subjectivized." I really like this book because it really nuances this idea that the post-literary society is something inherently negative, that communication through images and videos and messaging apps is something that is actually less legitimate than textual communication. The book Palestine Online is a pretty significant counter-argument to that. And to be honest, when we read McLuhan, the negative connotation people associate with the post-literate society isn't as obvious. McLuhan believed this transition onto a new media environment simply felt like a new stage in a long series of media environments, each shaping human perception in a different way. Maybe you don't remember the name McLuhan, but you've probably heard about this phrase, "the medium is the message." Well, that's from him. He thought electronic media could overwhelm people if they didn't stay aware of how media shaped them. "The medium is the message" means we need to study environments, media environments, not judge them. The information age. While doing the research for this video, I stumbled upon an essay which kind of set the tone for this video. Here it is, "The Dawn of the Post-Literate Age," and it was written by Patrick Tucker in 2009 for The Futurist. This article makes one point very clear. Writing is not a sacred artifact, but a tool. For thousands of years, text served as humans' most powerful technology for storing knowledge. From day tablets to printed books, writing allowed us to preserve information with a level of stability no other medium could match. You know, when you tell a friend a story, you can't really trust them to repeat that story exactly as it was said. However, when you write something, you know, it's pretty stable, the meaning stays there. But the article argues that the written word now faces something it has never faced before: competition from newer systems that can store and move information more quickly and more flexibly. Digital technologies like databases, cloud systems, and AI-driven tools may soon be able to take over many of the functions that used to belong exclusively to text. This shift becomes even more striking when we look at the paradox the article highlights, which is that even though fewer people seem to be reading traditional printed material, the amount of information produced worldwide is exploding. We generate more data every day than any centuries has ever produced, and yet much of this information is not expressed through the slow editor process of print. On the other hand, it's much more fragmented. It's comments, blogs, short posts, messages, and endless streams of digital content. But the article doesn't argue that we should reject new technologies outright. Instead, it suggests we should be cautious and deliberate about adopting them. Just because a device or platform is faster or more convenient doesn't automatically make it better. New tools should have to prove that they help people communicate more clearly, think more deeply, and share knowledge more responsibly. If written language is simply one technology among many, then any replacement must demonstrate genuine superiority, not just novelty. We should not allow technological change to happen to us by default, but rather evaluate each new tool on its real impact on human communication. This is where media literacy becomes essential. If information is a technology that can be reshaped, edited, and manipulated, then the most important skill for the future is not memorizing facts or clinging to older media, but understanding how information systems work. The article suggests that technological literacy may eventually be more important than traditional literacy, not because reading becomes irrelevant, but because people will need to know how to navigate and judge information in a world overflowing with it. Now, going back to the Sarah Herswitz clip we showed at the beginning, the Hillary Clinton's clip we showed at the beginning, instead of moral panic about declining reading habits, the focus should be on giving people the skills to tell good information from bad, to understand how digital platforms shape what we see, and to make informed choices about the tools they use. I really like this 2009 article because it leaves room for a more hopeful vision. It imagines a future where young people, far from being passive consumers of technology, become more selective and critical than the adults who market these tools to them. They might reject certain platforms, prefer older or simpler devices. We've seen that happening already. Or they might combine all their new media in ways that generally support their goals. This sort of resistance, choosing tools for value rather than convenience, is itself a sign of deep technological literacy. It suggests that a post-literate society does not have to be a society without depth. It can be one where people approach information with
awareness and autonomy, choosing the medium that serves them best rather than being shaped by it. So yeah, I'll end on this hopeful note. We like to tackle big topics on this channel, but ultimately we want to keep things hopeful, positive, if we can. I really hope you enjoyed this video. It was a bit more dense than my usual videos. I don't know. What do you think? Did you enjoy it? I appreciate feedback as long as it's communicated in a polite way, respectful and polite way. But yeah, thank you so much for watching. Don't forget to like, to subscribe if it's not already done. You can also support us on Patreon. As I mentioned earlier, we have a bunch of things happening over there that are exclusive to Patreon. And yeah, thank you again to NoCD for sponsoring the video. I think that's it for me. I'll just thank my Patreons. Actually, a big thank you, by the way, to top tier Patreons: Nofol Shamari, Fred, Hong Ching Huang, Paul Louis Agenau, Patrick Button, Jeff Lee, Yilan, Ty Martin. The battery died, as you probably guessed it, so I'll keep going over here. Big thank you to Nick, to Alina, to Brandon, Jem Siddle, Boris, Ojoal, Pablo, Patrick, Ria, Corrigi, Tristan, Christopher France, Christopher, Ion, Donage, Alex, Manuel, and Perry. And thank you to the other ones who prefer to stay anonymous. I think that's it for me. I'll see you in the next one. Salut! Actually, this is going to be great. I'm sure this is going to be great. I shouldn't say that.